Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos. Hope everyone had a great 4th of July weekend. Today's guest is Andy Black, Republican candidate for Hamilton County Commissioner, running against Alicia Reese for Todd Portune's former seat on the Board of Commissioners. I think he's going to have some news for us today, so looking forward to having him. But first, Sherry, how are you?
I'm good today. Saw you over the 4th of July weekend. We had a good time. So that was nice.
We did. We're not just podcast co-hosts. We're not just co-workers. We're also friends. Had a fun activity that we did over the weekends. Maybe we should save that for the fun segment of the show.
Agreed. Yeah. Serious subject, I think, at the beginning, huh?
Absolutely. And that would be City Council's vote to mandate the wearing of masks while inside any facility inside in the city of Cincinnati. Sherry, tell us the ins and outs of this and when all that's kicking in, and kind of what it means.
With the uptick of coronavirus cases and the idea that Hamilton County is a hotspot in the state, really all of Southwest Ohio, we're seeing, just a lot of cases and a lot of hospitalizations and percent increases. Those numbers change every day, so I'm not going to throw them out there. City Council followed in the footsteps of Dayton on Friday in a 7-2 vote that fell along party lines. They voted to mandate masks inside starting on Thursday.
So coming up this Thursday, you will be required to wear a mask while you're inside any public facility in the city. I don't mean publicly owned. I mean anywhere where the public can gather, in small businesses, big businesses, wherever. Anytime you're inside off your office building, you're inside a building within the city of Cincinnati, Kroger, you are required to wear a mask.
And for those who don't, it's a $25 fine.
I was getting ready to ask you that. How are they going to enforce that?
Well, I think that's the big question right now. And a lot of our reporting this week is centering on this. They're like, if you see someone without a mask, call the Cincinnati Health Department, 513-357-7200. And it's hard to imagine how this is going to go on Thursday. I think there's a lot of unknowns that we're trying to sort out. I mean, you're going to send out a health department worker. And some on council, are really like, we'll give them an option to put on masks. Maybe people could carry around masks, so there is an option. And it's just really, it's hard to see how this is going to go. And, one of the no votes, Jeff Pastor, he's like, we're not a nanny state or a nanny city. And so there was kind of that pushback on this.
Yeah, I find this to be a little, the enforcement of it is, I'm not sure. What am I trying to say? Government overreach, and how are you going to enforce this? And I'm just thinking hypotheticals, and say I'm inside Kroger here. I'm sitting in my car as we record this at Hyde Park Plaza, so I'm at the Hyde Park Plaza Kroger, and I see someone not wearing a mask. I'm gonna immediately dial this number and okay, we'll be there in 10 minutes, sir. And I don't know where that guy went or that lady went, whoever wasn't wearing the mask. And so I don't know how this is going to go. And I'm not sure if it's the best use of public resources. But that's my opinion on it. I do encourage people to wear a mask, and I do think that the government should be encouraging people to wear a mask. Mandating it and $25 fines and all that is like, okay. Seems, go ahead.
It's the kind of, it hits on like the trifecta of all the issues of our time, really. Like it hits on the coronavirus, and I should say, I'm a big social distance mask wearer for protection with all my asthma issues, and I wish everybody was doing the same thing, but they're not. And so then what do you do? So that's kind of where we're at in society. But, you know, there are underlying things with the idea that this is a city that's almost 50%, you know, under the poverty line. Masks aren't cheap. You know, I'm treating them like fashion accessories, but not everyone can afford to do that. Not everyone has masks. When you see people, I mean, I encourage everyone not to make snap judgments from covering poverty for so long on the city beat. You don't know what people's lives are like at home. And then on top of that, you know, we have a lot of questions about the idea of over-enforcement of just the orders themselves, of like who was getting trouble for violating the social distancing orders. And it hits on that too. And like, there's a lot of concern behind the scenes about making sure this is evenly, you know, enforced, and how is that going to work? Nobody thinks that we shouldn't be wearing masks, but it's just the idea of how we go about it. I haven't seen something this complicated come out of City Hall in a while.
Yeah. Aaron Glenn had a nice reporter. Aaron Glenn had a nice explainer on Cincinnati.com on Friday and over the weekend, in which, I mean, it was just, there was so many contradictions in this, not from her, but from the council, in which she highlighted. And one was like, you know, they'll give you a $25 fine, but they want to encourage you first to like wear a mask. And in some cases, maybe you will be given a mask. And so you'll be warned, or, you know, and then they also have the other, like, hey, we want to enforce this, but then we don't want to, you know, unfairly target people who are in poverty and maybe can't afford masks or don't have access to masks. So it was like, reading that was like the council just, you know, in theory, I think they had in their mind that like, okay, this is a really noble thing. And there's all these little details that they tried to, talk around or,
One of the things that was the most complicated about this, and this is really where Christopher Smitherman and Independent, nobody really knew where he was going to come down on this, because he's not an over-regulator kind of, you know, council member, as his Independent status does suggest, but he did vote for this. First of all, we're not alone. This is Dayton, Columbus, Cleveland. There's other smaller cities doing this too. And, you know, really the idea, it is being done in an emergency to combat something that's now. Like, this is not give something 3 meetings, have a committee meeting and really discuss this and have the people come in, which I'm always in favor of. I mean, originally the ordinance was supposed to go into like vote on Friday, take effect on Friday. It was like, whoa, 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 you can't really start a law like the day you pass it. And so they really settled on the 9th, right? Giving it a 6-day window there to kind of prepare people and businesses and things. And it just, this is really a lot of thorny issues in there. And I should also note, you know, this doesn't put the onus on the businesses. It's putting the onus on the person. And so nobody really wanted to hold businesses accountable and kind of go down that path. So they did not do that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. And we'll be following your coverage on this. I will say this. I am so tired of being lectured by government officials on the mask wearing. And I'm so tired of the partisanship of mask wearing. And that is both parties to blame for that. And I remember this back in, you know, May, even when it was really, it just became such a partisan issue. And being lectured along partisan lines about this, it's like, just stop. I just would really like to see folks, hey, use your logic and common sense and better judgment and wear a mask in your crowded areas, social distance, and hey, really encourage folks to do that. But like, to continue to be lectured on this is like from the government, and the arguments that are taking place, and that, you know, this whole thing, this whole notion of like, oh, if you're wearing a mask, you must vote for, you must vote this way. And if you're not wearing a mask, you must vote that way. It's just like, gosh, it gets me fired up, because this is something that should not be a partisan Republican Democrat thing, but certainly looking out for your fellow citizen and safety thing.
I will say the number one question I get asked at this moment, and I have no insight into this, by the way, but I think people think, oh, she's a reporter, she might know. You know, is our state going to follow other states and walk back, you know, and start reclosing things? And I don't have the answer to that. I mean, we're seeing states, Arizona, Texas, New York didn't even reopen indoor dining, which they had been set to do just because of how many cases there are. And I'm not sure what is coming in Ohio, but I do prefer a lecture over a lot of those new mandates if they come down.
Yeah, I don't see it happening in Ohio. I really don't. That's just my observation of the whole situation. But anyway.
But again, like, honestly, this is the most difficult thing I've really seen come out of City Hall. I mean, they talking about money and streetcar and all kind of things, right? There's no shortage, really, of debates. But this is the first, I think, real, like, public safety health thing and dealing with this. I think, you know, everyone's trying to make the best decision as they go along. And no easy task.
I take that back a little bit. I mean, I could potentially see a regional approach to maybe closing or reclosing or shutting things down, kind of like the governor has really shifted into this regional mode now, where, you know, he's got the whole color-coded emergency level thing. Is that right? It's like a color-coded system, right, where you're at a level certain, you're...
Yes, this is where you don't want to be red.
right. Yeah, the worst is red, yes. And I could see potentially when it comes to shutting down the economy or parts of the economy, I could see the governor more taking a regional approach to that the way he is now with, you know, determining, you know, the kind of the hot spots of COVID spikes across the state.
Well, I mean, and we certainly are that. And the idea with Dayton and Cincinnati doing what we're interested to see if those cases go down. I mean, that's really, you know, besides watching the enforcement, I mean, there's a lot of fallout to kind of keep track of here. And one of those things is if the cases do go down and if it helps.
Yeah. Yep. Let's shift gears. We'll be following your coverage on that at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter. Certainly on Cincinnati.com. I think there's a lot more to come on that issue, and how's that going to, because there's really, as of right now, Sherry, this is going to be in place for kind of indefinitely.
Yes, that's the thing. It has no end date because it's a mandate under the emergency order that the mayor issued. So yes, it's open-ended.
Yep. Let's shift gears. Let's bring in our special guest today, and that is Republican Andy Black, who's running for Hamilton County Commissioner. All right, special guest time here on the That's the Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome to the podcast for the first time Hamilton County Commissioner candidate, Republican Andy Black. Andy, how you doing?
I'm great, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for a happy summer, and hope you had a great 4th of July.
You too.
Former vice mayor of Marymount, running for countywide for the first time. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, first time running countywide, but I'm from Hamilton County. I've lived all over the county. I was born in Delhi, actually. My parents are one of those rare east side, west side relationships. My mother's a coal rain grad. My dad's a Madeira grad. So somehow they crossed the 75 boundary. Of course, we had to start off on the west side, and my brother and sister and I were all born on the west side and lived a few years there. But I was raised in Marymount, went to the Marymount Public Schools. From Marymount, graduated up the road to Oxford, to Miami University, the Miami University, and from there I went to Bellarmine University in Louisville. I was working full time for my first real job at a college. I spent the weekends at Bellarmine University, which is a small, similar to Xavier, small college there in Louisville. Got my MBA. And from there, just kind of focused on career. traveled a lot, and moved back to Cincinnati in about March of 2008, and was approached about running for council in Marymount. And, you know, not the same as a countywide race, but it was a good introduction into politics. Local politics, obviously, is the most personal or full contact, however you want to call it, politics. So was elected at the ripe age of 28 or 29, I can't recall, and served as a council representative and finance chairman for a couple of years. And then I was nominated and unanimously voted in to be vice mayor by my peers on council, and served as vice mayor for two terms. And then my wife and I decided we wanted to move, and fortunately moved out of the village. So we moved up the hill there, and my wife and I now live in Indian Hill with our two boys. They're 9 and 7. She works full time, running the family business. And here I am now running for county commissioner. So first question I get is why the hell do you want to do this? Fair question.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah, fair question. I got it from most of my family first off, then my friends. And then they of course ask, what is a county commissioner? But the first, you know, the first question is a fair one. Why do I want to do this? And really it comes down to, you know, I saw the shift growing up in the city go from sort of a balanced Republican Democrat to all Democrat. And then in 2018, I think it was, when Chris Monzel was defeated by Ms. Dumas, I saw the county go all Democrat. And, you know, say what you will about politics, but one side of government or one party government isn't good at any level, in my opinion. So that really got me interested in county politics, and started asking around, you know, talking to some former folks who've been on the commission, and talking to folks who were involved in politics in the local level. You know, what am I getting myself into? And I decided to make the leap last May. So I've been at this for a long time, I feel like, already fundraising and getting out and meeting folks all over the county, in the city, out in the suburbs, in the east side, the west side, the north side, even in Wyoming, Jason. And, you know, I've gotten a good feel for what's driving folks. Obviously, COVID-19 threw everything for kind of a sharp turn. But, you know, we're back, you know, we're somewhat back in campaigning mode. I mean, we can't do the parades or the festivals, but, you know, just talking with residents and explaining, you know, this is, checks and balances matter. Balanced government matters. Not just from a, hey, isn't it great to have two parties? And I know in the past Republicans have had full control. I totally acknowledge that. But, you know, now at this point in our city and county, you know, governments, when we have one party in full supermajority control, I just don't think it's going to bode well for the residents. When you look at what's transpired in Cuyahoga County with Cleveland, where they're all one party control, or a little further north of that in Wayne County, Detroit, or go to Cook County, my gosh, they're all controlled by one party. It happens to be the Democratic Party. So that's really why I got into the race. And the more I've gotten involved in digging into the finances, like any good fiscal conservative would do, it's concerned me, because I see that there are some serious issues coming down the pike. And I know there's a performance audit that's due back from the county. They've partnered with a third party and with the CBC to fund that. I'm interested to see what the findings are. But, you know, our campaign has been focused on, as I said earlier, going out, explaining to the voters what's transpiring right now, and then what we're facing. And the fiscal reality is that we've got a deficit that was projected for 2023, and it's going to be moved up now, we believe, to 2021. And for those who are keeping score at home, that's only 5 months away. So, you know, those are two reasons, two of the most more concrete reasons why I got into this.
You left out a key detail in your bio that's that you played football at Miami.
Oh yeah. Well, played is a very friendly term. I was a walk-on, but I was not able to break the sideline line there, because there was a quarterback that, his name is Ben Roethlisberger, that was about 14 spots ahead of me. So he was the starter. I was quickly moved over to defense, and it was not nearly Division I A caliber, but I appreciate you bringing that up. It did teach me a lot about resilience, a lot about commitment, perseverance, discipline, the things that you need in politics. Definitely carry over.
And we did
beat Marshall. Sorry.
One time you beat Marshall. One time.
That's true.
So you went 3-1. Would you play 4 years?
No, just two. When I transferred into Miami, and I was there for the 2000-2001 seasons.
So you went 1-1 against the Herd.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to learn a little bit about Huntington. But anyway, speaking of football,
yes,
the big issue. How's this for a segue? Speaking of football, you uh, The big issue in this commission race is clearly the future of the Bengals and Paul Brown Stadium with the lease coming up in 2026.
Correct.
And so there's been a lot of focus on this race about that issue. You have an interesting idea for how you want to approach this, the stadium issue.
Mm-hmm.
Please share that with us.
Okay. So it's almost been a year to the day. I had one of the folks who's been kind of advising my campaign is now our campaign chairman, Mike Mezer, who you may recall ran for auditor back several years ago in 2014. And he came to the idea of, hey, I think we need to think bold, think large when we talk about what we're going to come out with an agenda. The old tax and spend and cut taxes as a Republican is, it's old. People have heard it. It's really not going to move the dial from a political standpoint. I thought, okay, politics is important, but what is actually going to influence people once elected? And so he came to me the idea, and I think it was June of 2019, to we need to look at as a county selling Paul Brown Stadium. And I stopped and I looked at him and I said, is this like a build the wall? Are we going to make Kentucky pay for this at the same time? Are we going to try to spin that? He said, no, I'm being dead serious. He said, I think right now, the way the county's projecting their sales tax reserve fund, which is what funds the stadiums, not just Paul Brown, but Great American Ballpark. And given the climate that we're going to be facing, it's something we should seriously be considering. And quite frankly, it's been discussed by Democratic commissioners in the past, but nobody's really had I don't know if it's been the interest to pursue it. So we put in, again, 11 months of work digging into a lease, which is almost as thick as a phone book, looking into the county finances, pulling all the county sources we could get our hands on. I have a team of advisors that have been working really, I mean, I can't ask for a better team, from a CFA to an attorney to a partner of mine who's now in the global asset management business, so understands infrastructure deals like this and how they work with county governments, not just investment banking, but how you actually put this deal together. So we've taken a lot of time, put a lot of resources, invested personal time that I can't thank these folks enough to really understand how would this work and what would the county net gain by potentially selling that asset right there on the river. It's our front door. Again, I admit it, at first it seems crazy, but if we walk through it, and if you've got time, I'd love to go through it here and explain why I think it's important. And again, these are county sources. This is county data. To be clear, we're not picking sides in this. We're not picking Browns. I mean, the Brown friend, the Bengals. We're not picking who should be the owners of this asset. I'm simply laying out a case that we have an asset right now that sucks a tremendous amount of money. I mean, a disproportionate amount of money out of our county taxpayers' pockets. I'm talking sales tax as well as property tax. Don't forget the property tax rollback, which I'll explain here. And I don't see a great opportunity for return anytime in the near future. So if I may, I'll walk through here and kind of give you our position on this, and then, you know, stop and ask questions, because this can get a little convoluted. But again, I think this is something that requires serious consideration, win or lose in November. I'll be clear about that. I think the county commissioners should be looking at this and looking at this as a bipartisan plan. Fair enough?
Fair enough, Sherry. Okay. Is there anything you want to ask?
I have roughly 1,000 questions. I'm going to let you walk through it. And I will say, I agree with you. You know, this has come up before. I have not seen any serious plans. And I know before we decided to talk about this on the podcast, you do have a very serious plan that's more, I think, laid out than just, you know, this really being an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And from covering the commission myself for 4 years, I mean, this is something that I saw that people, you know, were really interested in. Citizens were interested in. And so, I mean, this is definitely worth something, like an idea of like exploring just to see what this looks like. I mean, I think every option should be on the table probably.
That's our campaign motto right there, has been all options on the table. I've written an op-ed about that, and this is one of the options that I think should be considered. So I'll start first with, you know, why is the county in the stadium business, or why are we even in this position? So if you go back to 1970, before I was even born, before my folks were even married, quite frankly, there was a Riverfront Stadium development group, and they decided they're going to build a multifunction sports facility on the river. So if for those who've either read your Inquirer articles or done their history, it opened at the All-Star break, I believe it was in June 1970, for about $50 million, which seems like pennies in today's dollars, but a lot of money. And unfortunately, that stadium only lasted 32 years. The Reds and the Bengals leased it from the city of Cincinnati. The county wasn't involved. And unfortunately, that didn't turn out well for anybody, because little did the Reds, the Bengals know, but they actually didn't even finish construction, quite frankly, the lower levels of the stadium when it was originally built. And then they failed as a city, failed to maintain it, because like the county, they're not set up to run major venues like this, and they don't have the infrastructure, the dollars necessarily in place to go out and run this year round, specifically when it's a multifunction stadium. So that deal obviously was not the model. And fast forward to 1996, and the county commissioners stepped in and said, hey, Bengals are threatening to leave. We're going to see if we can get a half-cent sales tax approved by the voters. In exchange for that, we'll build not one but two stadiums, Paul Brown Stadium, as we know today, and Great American Ballpark, to keep the Bengals here and obviously keep the Reds. The Reds weren't threatening to leave, but keep two professional sports teams here because we want to be a major league sports town. Good for the economy, good for everybody, right? Unfortunately, what they forecasted from a sales tax revenue was about 3%. And that number has never been hit. So what does that mean? That means that at the time we're trying to not only bring in more tax dollars, we also committed to provide a property tax rollback to property tax owners of 30%. To date, that has not happened very often. And I'll get into the details of that later. So you couple those two things together. You got a half cent sales tax promised to cover two stadiums. You've got a shortfall in what your sales tax revenues were forecasted. And you've got a commitment to the taxpayers up front. You've bitten off quite a bit up front. And again, these were not Democrats or that were running this commission. I understand it was Republicans. So I acknowledge it up front. This was a deal that at the time, a lot of folks were considering, a lot of cities and counties were looking at and saying, we don't want to become a tier two city. I lived in Louisville. I love Louisville, but we don't want to turn into a second class city. So we got to do everything we can to keep these major league, franchises here. And they made the decision, and they went out and they got the public support, and the taxpayers said, you know what, for a half a penny of sales tax, yeah, we're on board. We want to keep the Bengals. We love our Bengals. To be clear, I was a Bengals fan and still am. So Paul Brown Stadium opens in what, 2000 it was. It cost $455 million once it was all said and done, which was over budget. Big surprise. And what the deal said is that it was supposed to be through 2026. The Bengals had the initial lease with options, 5-2-year options, after 2026, which would take them to 2036. The final term obviously being 2034 to 2036. What's interesting about this lease that wasn't part of the Riverfront Stadium lease is that the county is on the hook, not just to build the, construct it. They're on the hook for the repairs, the maintenance and the enhancements, which the enhancements is key. And we'll talk about that here in a second, but those were very clearly stated. Those are things that the Bengals had to have in order to stay here. They went through it with the city. It didn't work out well, and they weren't going to be suckered again into some deal where the stadium is crumbling around them. I'll stop right there. If you have any questions, Sherry, I said you have 1,000 or 1,000,000.
Well, it's really into more about your plan, but we're good. This is a good background.
Good background.
A refresher, because it's hard to put in every story, and we've written millions of stories about this. But all right, good background. Keep going.
Okay, good deal. So just to come full circle and finish this off, so just to keep people, put this in perspective, the county has spent to date on construction, debt service, which is paying off the stadium loans, repairs, maintenance, enhancements, they spent approximately $825 million in that stadium. So almost $1 billion. They'll be crossing the $1 billion threshold pretty soon here. What the county has collected in revenues is just about $36 million. So not a great investment in any way, shape, or form. That stadium, as we know, only operates to be 12 to 15 times a year. So just not a good model for a successful asset manager of any kind. Just to be clear, by comparison, Great American Ballpark operates at a much smaller number. It costs less. They use 81 times a year. But again, this isn't about picking sides. This is a different venue, different environment. So where are we today, and how are we getting out of this mess? So to be clear, the general fund is predicted by the county commissioners is going to be about 20% short of what they expected in revenues. So that means that they're going to obviously have to figure out some way to make up for that. They've already taken what was the museum tax, the icon tax, rolled it into the general fund. And they, even when they did that, and I opposed that, I said, if you're going to take the tax that was obligated for one thing and put in the general fund, I think you got to take it back to the tax, the taxpayers, and let them have a say. They obviously disagreed. They put it through 3-0. Again, back to my balanced government argument, and the tax, the $40 million that was obligated for music hall and for the union terminal is now in the general fund. Even with that, they're going to be short. So now let's shift over to the sales tax reserve fund, which is what funds the stadiums. The county right now has about $44 million. Think of that as their checkbook in their pocket to run and operate these stadiums. Now, that's a flat number, and that looks like $44 million is a lot of money. That seems like you're okay in a good spot. They'll continue to bring in sales tax reserves. Money will go back up once we get out of this COVID. The problem is that that doesn't account for the enhancements. And for those who listen to your program and those who've read the paper, the county just got involved in a deal where they swapped out for Hilltop. They purchased that property and offered to delay the enhancements. The Bengals forgave that, essentially, till about 2024, 2025, to be determined, the exact date. But at some point, their lease stipulates they are allowed to ask for up to $250 million in enhancements to be on par with other NFL stadiums. Again, that enhancement clause was key when they signed this deal to make sure that they didn't fall behind and have a stadium that's crumbling underneath them. So $44 million, in my mind, is not exactly a fair assessment of where we are. Yes, that's what's in the bank, but that's not counting your obligations, your debt obligations. Fast forward to 2026, we estimate that to be about $300 million with the inflationary rate. So what that means is by 2027, the county will by 2032, the county will have a negative reserve fund of about $94 million. And again, that's just for the enhancements alone. We're not even talking about the property tax rollback that they've not paid back to taxpayers. So in today's dollars,
in full,
they've paid back approximately 15% on average from 1997 to 2019. So of that 30%, they're paying about half of it back. If we were to take the county and hold them at their word and say, you know what, you got to make yourself whole with your property tax owners, that means they have to send every property tax owner a check for $500 today, just to get out of that hole and be free, just to be free and clear of that debt alone. So you couple the enhancements with the property tax rollback that they're not paying, and to say that you're $44 million in the positive, I think is misleading, to be honest. I think that's very misleading. But that's the way that their numbers are shaken out. That's the way that they're positioned to the taxpayers. So I think if you look at it, how do you get out of that? What are we going to do as a county to make sure that we're not facing these unprecedented debt levels, not just in the general fund, but also the sales tax reserve? Sell the stadium. Go out to the market, leverage the economic opportunity zones that were passed in 2017 and have been implemented since 2018. It sits in an economic opportunity zone right now, which means that investors like FC Cincinnati can go in and invest in that land with some significant tax advantages, with the caveat that they have to continue to improve the property. They can't just buy it and be squatters and basically use it as a tax shelter. So I think that's one thing that could draw folks in. And quite frankly, folks who are in this business, asset managers, insurance companies, people that have cash at hand that want to invest in properties like this on the riverfront could better utilize it. We could use it 20, 25 times a year and make this a more of a premier event center and not just the Bengals home turf 8-10 times a year. So there's a number of ways we could go about doing this. I think that the most common example you'll see is occurring actually overseas, where folks are using public-private partnerships. They're able to go out and use some county dollars or some local dollars, but also rely on investors to come in and finance a lot of the enhancements, a lot of the maintenance, a lot of the operations, versus the county doing it all on their own right now. So again, the first question that I get from folks is how does this work? And what do the Bengals, the Browns, or what does the county stand to gain from it? Well, the county obviously gains pretty immediately the fact that they could have a cash influx and help pay down some of these other debts. The Browns and the Bengals, in my opinion, what they're going to get is a capable landlord, somebody who can actually enhance the stadium, who has the reserves. They're not taking a black eye every time they want to do an upgrade, every time they want to have a stadium improvement or a scoreboard improvement. Anything they want to do, obviously, is going to be tarnished with the perception that the public is funding it, which they are. So in my opinion, it's a win-win. We've tried in the past suing the Bengals. We've tried browbeating them in PR. It doesn't work. This is the only solution I believe that truly is worth considering as we get closer to 2026. But we can't wait until 2024 or 2025 to either put it to a vote or to talk to the Bengals and Browns. We need to start now. Economic opportunity zones are set to expire in 2023. So now is the time I think we need to start having this conversation so we're not up against a barrel like they were in 1996.
All right, so here is my main question. Why, if the county is not making any money on these, would a private investor look to themselves and be like, well, we can make money on these things, especially in a time when there's no, you know, butts in seats, no fans?
Well, that's the challenge is you find the investors who, which there are investors, this is happening around the country, who are willing to make investments in these basically assets that are fully underutilized. And you bring in a group that's a mix of either investors and vendor management groups and entertainment groups that'll look at this and say, all right, using it 12 times a year, we could stand a 6-8% return if we use this 20 times a year. You know, I know they're looking at you having the World Cup. We're looking at having concerts. Once COVID passes and we're able to go back to business as normal, there is a model there that we have, and I'd be happy to provide the details to you, that shows that there is an opportunity there for investors to get that 8-9% return. They're not looking for 20-25% returns in our conversations. We vetted this with the investment community. We've talked to folks who've done this in other cities with private and public partnerships, not stadiums, to be clear. Not stadiums directly. There are obviously partnerships like we see at FC Cincinnati. Columbus Crew has a privately owned venue, but it's turned to the county for parking or for other investments. And we think that's the model we should be looking at, rather than the county owns, the county operates, county has to pay all the debt, and the county gets literally an actual quarter for every ticket sale that occurs at that stadium.
But would selling it break the lease with the teams?
You have to get the Bengals and the Brown family to the table. You have to say, look, this is to get you, as I said earlier, this is to get you a landlord that can afford this. The county can't afford to get you what you want. If you want to have Riverfront Stadium Part 2, we can continue down this path with blinders on, in our opinion, and face that crossroads once again like we did in 1996. This absolutely, and we admit it up front, this requires the Brown family, the Bengals, to get involved in this conversation and be willing. They could be an owner of the stadium. They could be a partner. They could be a 51% owner of the stadium, but the county just cannot afford to continue to go on this path.
Well, that is sort of this last statement I certainly agree with. But, mm-hmm. you know, their businesses, and let's look at the county and say the county's mm-hmm. a business, right? And everybody's mm-hmm. trying to do the best thing for their bottom line. Mm-hmm. Like, the best thing for the Reds and the Bengals' bottom line is to keep these fabulous leases. Like, I mean.
I'm not refuting that they're not in the business of managing and operating. We're coming to them and saying, this is a prime piece of real estate. If you have the means and you have partners who are willing to come in, you could own this property and you could then leverage it yourself. And you could also capitalize on the fact that it's your stadium, your team. We think there is an argument to be made there.
All right. One more question, Jason. I'm sure. Sorry, because I covered this for such a long time. Okay. So what's to keep, let's say, we find someone to buy the land. Now, on the other side, or in the middle, as this case might be, right? The, you know, taxpayers have also put, you know, $1 billion of investment into the bank, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And Jason, we'll let you comment after that. $1 billion. And what's to say, okay, well, now I own this prime riverfront land that had a stadium. Now, yep. These teams can sell and go to a different city. We'd lose the teams. And then they were like, ooh, prime real estate. What's to say that?
Yeah, you mean land robbers or land barons, whatever you want to call them. That's a fair point. And one of the first questions we discussed as our team is the county, is it wise to even want to give this up? And in our assessment here, it goes back to, if you can't afford it, which we obviously are not in the path to be able to afford it, it's one that you need to be looking at as, where are your most valuable assets and where could you get a return on your asset, a return on the investment, even though right now it's completely upside down, where could you get a most likely buyer? I think there's other assets around the county too that we should be looking at, but this is the most expensive one, by far and away the most expensive one, from a construction debt service to the financing of the operations and the actual enhancements that are due. This is by far and away the most expensive asset the county owns. And I think that there's, again, not to be redundant, but I think there is a investment community or investment group out there that would look at this and say, and the county would still have to be involved. Let's be clear about this, because the county, we're not going to cut the tax, the half cent sales tax, and it goes away, because the county still has obligations to Great American Ballpark. So the way we see this is happening is the county would still have some operating expense or some expense involvement in this, but we'd structure the lease and structure the deal so it's not so one side, and the county shoulders all the burden and has little to no revenue to show for it. So it's going back to the drawing board, as I said, getting the Brown family to the table, going back, reworking the lease, and seeing if they're able to come to the table themselves or come to the table with a group that would be interested in owning this piece of property.
Why do you think this hasn't happened across America in American stadiums and arenas?
Well, I think you're going to start to see, you're seeing a lot of sports entertainment hedge funds pop up. You're seeing a lot of folks who are interested in buying sports teams, and they're buying local organizations for their arenas, for their smaller venues, not something the size of Paul Brown Stadium, I'll admit that. But you are seeing it, Jason, where folks are coming in and buying up minor league baseball teams, and they want the property. They're buying up hockey arenas because they want to be able to use those for concerts, and they're selling them out far more often for concerts and other venues, conventions, you name it, rather than they are for the actual team that they purchased it for. They want that asset. So I think you'll start to see it. The flip side of that, what you are seeing, and you say, there's examples of it all over the country, where municipalities who have a much smaller portion of their debt service owed for their stadiums are starting to look at these and say, we're not going to make these payments. It's occurred up in Minneapolis where they defaulted on it. And let me just tell you, that's not something the county ever wants to be in the position of, because then your rating goes to junk status rating and you can't get a dollar to build anything or borrow any money to do anything with the county. So you are starting to see municipalities look at the flip side of that and say, all right, how do we potentially get out of this obligation that we're not able to provide core services, which is really, at the end of the day, my message is this. If we get out of the stadium obligation, we can then fund some of these programs that people consider core. I consider core infrastructure, law and order. You get on the list, homelessness, opioid epidemics. You get on the list of things that we have put on the back burner or have not been able to fully fund, and be able to fund those programs rather than funding a stadium that's used 12, 15 times a year.
And you're right on that. I looked this up, and I think the pendulum is swinging in the financing of sports stadiums and arenas in this country, and these are on a smaller scale.
Yep.
But, the Orlando City Stadium, their MLS stadium, it cost $155 million. Obviously, a drop in the bucket compared to Paul Brown Stadium. But there was zero public money that went into that. That was private money. Mm-hmm. The Las Vegas, they have a new arena there. 2016 was when it was built. Same kind of thing, $375 million.
What's the Rams cost? The Rams is like $2 billion all private money, right?
I don't know the exact amount of private money, but there's a lot of private money. The Kroenke sports groups put a lot of private money mm-hmm. into that as well. Do you think, given where we are at, certainly, you know, even when you started this idea a year ago, you didn't know what was coming in 2020. Mm-hmm. But do you think maybe even 2020 and the economic issues of the COVID has created, does that maybe even enhance your argument for this?
I think it speeds it up. Yeah, I mean, it does. We're going to see a slow recovery, I think, coming out of this. We're already looking at general fund budget deficits. I think that it's a matter of time, as I explained earlier, before the enhancements are required per the lease by the Bengals, which will take that sales tax reserve fund that's in the positive and quickly turn it upside down. I mean, this year they had to delay some of the minor upgrades. When I say minor, $800,000 is not a small amount of money, but when you're talking about only potentially $300 million in enhancements, and they're having to kick the can on the road for $800,000, that's pretty telling, I believe. So I think it has expedited the process. There's only so much more you can ask from the taxpayers. I mean, you got the Metro bus levy just passed, obviously very closely, but it did pass. And you've got the museum tax already shifted into the general fund. So at some point, people are going to start to leave the county. And I don't think it's going to happen overnight. But I do believe that if we continue down this path, we'll start to see our county turn into what I listed off earlier, and some of those other Midwest counties where people just get out and they go live further out and less expensive areas.
Have you pitched this to the Bengals yet? Have you talked to anyone from?
So we've reached out to them a couple times. They're aware of the idea, but have I done this pitch to them? No, I've not. Sherry?
So what do you think the rest of this whole campaign season is going to look like no campaign season we've ever seen, right? Like how do you get this message out there? And, you know, do you anticipate there's going to be debates? Do you think this is going to be like a main conversation in, you know, this race? What does this, the rest of this year until the election look like?
About 17 weeks and a couple days, right? So, we've got a pretty strategic roadmap that we've been having to adjust according to COVID, but, in terms of getting out and meeting folks, we're still going to do some smaller events, obviously many more smaller events and larger events that we were planning to. doing some door-to-door where it's appropriate, obviously maintaining 6 feet, wearing masks, all those things we need to do. But trying to make this, you know, trying to make folks understand it's a complex issue. I get it. I don't pretend to be a financial wizard by any means. That's why I have a group, great group of advisors that have helped me kind of digest this. But if we break it down into what matters and where we are to the taxpayers, again, I go back to that number. If the property tax rollback fund in itself has been shorted $90+ million to the Hamilton County residents, property owners, since this vote passed in 1996, you know, that's $500 per homeowner that would be coming back to them. You know, $500 is not going to go out and make somebody's year, but it's a car payment. I mean, it's relatable. And I think that's what we want folks to understand, that this is big money that is not being even discussed. It's not even being accounted for anymore because it's just an afterthought. It's, well, we certainly can't make the property tax rollback payment whole because we're in such deficits. Well, by all means, let's continue down that path and just assume for the best. I think that's wrong. It doesn't work as a board of directors for a company. That board would be fired overnight if they continue to spend. You got to look under every rock. Again, all options on the table. Look at your assets and figure out how do we get out of this, and what are we going to do that's radically different than we've done in the past. So, not sure if I answered your question, Sherry, but in terms of the campaign itself, you know, we're going to be doing online. We're going to be focusing on traditional media buys. Fundraising, of course, is still going on. It has been going on. And we're going to try to get our message out there, because being a first-time candidate countywide, I recognize it's an uphill battle, but we're out here every day. I mean, it's to Jason's question earlier about being a walk-on. You don't get those, you know, you don't get accepted in a group like that by just showing up. You got to go out and make sure you're knocking every door and you put in the effort. So I'm committed to doing that.
What's a good example in American infrastructure? And, you know, I know there have been toll roads that, you know, public mm-hmm. infrastructure has been sold over to the private sector. You know, there have been toll roads that have been done that. And,
yep.
You know, certainly the private sector is interested in that, is that you make the money on the tolls and you can repay the debt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an example that you and your team have looked at across the country that you said, oh, look at that, that's a perfect example of a public-private partnership that is working?
Well, it's relatively new to the U.S. to be clear. So this wasn't even around when they started building the stadiums back in 1996 or 97, wherever they started construction. So this is a new concept. It's been deployed, or whatever you want to call it, utilized overseas. I think I mentioned earlier there are some soccer stadiums over in Europe that have done this type of a partnership, but
correct.
It's really
that
just,
is true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It has just started here in the U.S. So, toll roads is one. It sounds a little dark, but they built Fort Leavenworth, Kansas prison, for example, was in this exact manner. It was set up as a public private partnership. It's still in place. The team that I work with right now, one of the advisors, was a part of that deal. There's other opportunities they're looking at in some of the counties in Michigan that they've been investigating. They haven't actually put it forward yet and actually closed the deal, but there are interested parties out there that are looking at, all right, private entity, cash is cheap, bonds are still a pretty safe investment, economic opportunity zones, you put those three things together and you can get yourself a 6-9% return. People are willing to do that, and I think you'll see more of it. But just we're at the cutting edge of this, and wouldn't it be not so Cincinnati to wait until Columbus does it, and then Indianapolis does it, and then Nashville does it, and then Cincinnati says, hey, let's try that. Let's get out ahead. Let's be one of the first ones to do this. Let's do it now. Let's not wait until all of a sudden we've had all of our peer communities around us do it and spent another X millions of dollars on maintaining the stadium and enhancing the stadium.
And this has been mentioned before. David Pepper in 2008 brought this up. Chris Monzel, David Pepper, Democrat, mm-hmm. Chris Monzel, a couple years after that, a Republican, also brought it up. Hey, sell the stadiums. The issue ultimately at that time, that was certainly a decade ago, was that the county owed too much debt for the private sector to take on.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later here, do you see it differently now?
Well, I mean, there is obviously a commitment to the enhancements is a big one. But there is a debt service obligation. They pay about $38 million a year in debt service in the stadium alone. And that won't be paid off until 2032. So, mm-hmm. yeah, there is a large amount of money that is going to be required. And that's why I said earlier, the county will not be free and clear into this deal. I mean, this has been something that I know, like you said, Democrats, Republicans have talked about it. But the debt was so insurmountable that we had no way of getting out of it. This at least gives us an opportunity to breathe a little bit, still saying we'll still have to stay involved. We'll still have to collect the sales tax revenue to fund, again, Great American Ballpark and fund part of Paul Brown Stadium. But it won't put us on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars down the road. And I think that's the real takeaway I want people to understand, that it's not just the debt service and what we owe. It's what we're legally committed to do to the Bengals. And that's really what concerns me the most.
So the public part of this public-private partnership that you're pitching here is that the county would continue to pay off the debts of the stadium.
That would be
the public's responsibility.
It depends on what we're going to get for the stadium. It depends on what the partnership is structured. It can be structured a number of ways, but there will be some either a maintenance commitment, or it could be paying down the debt. It could be paying down part of the debt. There's just so many different ways you can structure these deals that I can't say firmly it'll be this column the county will still have to pay. These two columns will be on the private investors, but there will be a public-private partnership model that will require, again, the county to still stay involved, but again, not have the same level of commitment they have today.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, to be clear, I mean, the county is today on an annual basis, the county is spending, I believe it's $52 million they're spending for Paul Brown Stadium debt service and maintenance and operations alone. Yeah. So $52 million, just to be clear, when you compare it to our peers, is exponentially higher. I mean, tenfold higher than some of these communities I was referencing earlier, where they're paying $2-3 million. We're spending $50 million. We're not exactly in a city like New York City where we have that type of a tax base to rely on. So it was a tough deal to come out of the gate, and then with the sales tax revenues being a full 1% short, averaging about 2% when they expected 3%, we're just in a position now where I think this needs to be considered.
I know we're talking hypotheticals and different mm-hmm. ideas. Is this something that basically I can't see the private sector coming in and saying, okay, so what the stadium costs $500 million to mm-hmm. build, and the private sectors are going to come in and buy the asset for what it's worth right now.
No.
But
not like
something where the private sector would come in and the public sector would come in and say, all right, we'll turn this over to you for a dollar kind of thing, and you take on all the responsibilities.
You know, it may be, again, I don't want to speculate, because there is something to be said for when we do, if we are able to get this out, get this through the other commissioners of support and put it out to the public, I don't know what we'll be asking for. I don't know what a fair number is to expect. Could end up in one of the situations where it's, you take on the maintenance and the enhancements, and we'll take on the debt. It could be that, but I just don't know yet. It's just too early to tell.
Gotcha. Sherry?
I just feel like this is going to need a lot of vetting, but, you know, mm-hmm. this is one of the best things when it comes to races, and an important thing in the commissioner's race, where, you know, there's two seats open at one time and then one seat 2 years later. Ideas come out. It's like, and then we have, like the different ideas come in, vetting of how things are done. And, you know, we really saw, and you're sounding a little bit like Chris Monzel during the race, you know, when he was running, he had a lot of ideas like that. And he did win and was on the commission, and it was a balanced commission at that point with Democrats and Republicans. And so this is where the ideas come from.
But I will say, Andy, it at least from my research, and Sherry's written stories about this, of anyone who's brought this up, you've put way, way, way more work and time into vetting this and thinking about this and looking at it, researching it. And certainly you have a whole team. And, you know, I sat down with you, was that 3 weeks ago or so?
Yeah.
With your team. You've done more work on this than I think anyone else, any candidate or politician, has ever done on it.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, it was something that at first blush I thought, okay, sure, yeah, let's sell the stadium. And I know that may seem at first blush, when somebody hears this, that could be the response. But as we get out and explain it, or if you want to go to the website sellthestadium.com and research it yourself, I think folks will see that this is one of those options that should be considered. I don't think that in the past, the environment has been, it was the same as it is today. I'm not going to repeat all the talking points once again, but those factors do weigh into this being a little bit different. I know Chris has talked about it. I know, as you mentioned earlier, others from the other side of the aisle have, and I truly hope that if elected, and I'm confident that we're going to win in November, that this is something that the commission, other commissioners will get behind and say, you know what, we keep pulling money from our right pocket and putting our left pocket every year. How do we finally get out of this mess? And this is something we should be considering once and for all and actually taking it seriously, because we've done the homework. And I think there's an investment community out there, assuming I can get to the, obviously the Brown family to the table to hear us out, that would be worth their time and investment.
Wow. Really appreciate you taking the time with it. And the website again that people can check this
sell,
out.
Yeah, it's all one word, sellthestadium.com.
Sellthestadium.com.
You can also find it at blackforhamiltoncounty.com, of course. I have to do a shameless plug there. But yeah, it's sellthestadium.com is the website dedicated to this one idea.
Gotcha.
And then you can check out, obviously, do your research, do your homework, look at it. I know you have, Jason. I know you share. You've been around this a long time. But I can't emphasize enough that I think this is the opportunity is ripe, and to wait until the lease negotiations or even in the near future, I think would be too late. And I think folks need to get that their mind around the idea that we've got deficits in the near future, not in 2026, that we need to be worried about.
And I know we've talked so much about this, Andy, and this is really, I think, going to dominate this election cycle in this race. With Alicia Reese, and but is there any other issue or issues in this race that you think are going to be critical?
You know, I mean, there are things that have obviously changed so much in 2020. The dynamic of what we thought our campaign focus would be on, COVID has changed it completely from not only a scheduling but from, you know, how our finances are going to shift. I do believe this is a role, like I said earlier, as a member of a board of directors, where my job, the commissioner's job, is not to manage the personnel of the coroner's office or the prosecutor's office, the sheriff's office. It is to sit down and come up with a budget that keeps the county aligned, keeps us in the black, doesn't go in the red. And I do believe, even though this is a special reserve fund, the sales tax reserve fund is different than general fund, you know, this issue, it should dominate, because it's been discussed for over 20 years now, I feel like, ever since the vote passed. It's been lawsuits. It's been discussions. It's time to take this head on. And I hope that we can have an honest, you know, candid debate about it. If there are other ideas, I'm open to it. I'm not saying this is the be all end all, but I do believe this is probably the most realistic way of getting the county back on its footing.
How much, real quick, how much money have you raised so far? I know you'd raised a lot through the end of last year and early this year. What's your fundraising up to now?
We're just over $250,000. Proud to obviously have all the support from all over the county, mind you. Proud to have a lot of support from the folks here, realize that this is a critical time. I know that a lot of people believe that the county's gone all blue. Our numbers don't show that. We show that we still have a good opportunity here to bring back some common sense business experience. I'm not a career politician. I don't plan on being a career politician. I just want to take the opportunity now to truly go out and try to get this county on fiscal footing that allows for my family, my kids' kids to have a county that I grew up in, be there 20 years from now.
Andy, good stuff. Thanks so much. Really looking forward to, talking to you more about this. And certainly it's an idea that I think is going to pique a lot of interest from county voters. So
I appreciate the time, Sherry. Jason, thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Bye-bye.
I know.
All right. Thanks again to Andy Black. Certainly will be interesting to see if what comes of his idea here, and if it gets legs, and see if some people get behind it. Anyway, let's shift into let's get away from the politics and all that stuff. Shift into our, what we call our fun segment. Sherry, we talked about it a little bit at the top of the episode here. You and I and some friends hung out on Friday and tell everyone what we did.
We went kayaking on Caesar Creek Lake Park. It's a lovely state park about 45 minutes north of the city.
It was a lot of fun. I christened my new kayak. It was rough in the beginning, Sherry.
True story.
But then once I got going, man, I had an absolute blast.
It was such a great day out there. I will say, I didn't realize you were christening it. I did not know that. Shame on me for not getting you out there sooner then.
Well, I just gotten it late last summer, and that didn't just because of fall, and I just didn't get it out. And I mean, I've gone kayaking before using other kayaks, renting or using someone else's kayak. I just hadn't used that kayak. But the difference is that I bought a sit-on-top kayak, and I had not ever used one of those before.
And it was a little choppier than I thought that it was going to be or had been in my previous experience there. Also, cut you some slack.
Well, my takeaway from that was the choppy water, because where we put the kayaks in is also where people put jet skis in, and then right around the corners where they put boats in. And my takeaway from that was because there were so many jet skis going in and out of that water, and the boats that were buzzing by, it was that people were ready to get out and enjoy themselves, and tired of being inside. And that was just my takeaway. Like, there were so many people there. And there, so the water was constantly, there was constantly a wake there as we were getting in the lake with our kayaks. And that was a challenge for me on the sit on top kayak for the first time.
I did love, because we're still socially distanced. I think a lot of the things that are open are being overwhelmed. I'm seeing that with some various places, and that makes things a little harder. But, you know, we were just socially distanced in our group and not near anyone else on the lake. It's a gigantic lake. And so that was really something that I liked about it a lot, and we're planning on going back a lot.
Oh, yeah. Great activity. I'm already scouting out some other areas. Went in woods. I went up there on Sunday, scouted out there, kayaking situation. So that'll be a thing where I can just, even like after work, just run up there and throw the kayak in the water for an hour and paddle around and get a little exercise.
There was that. I was really tired that night.
Oh man, I was too.
We were out there pretty sore
the next day.
We stopped in Lebanon, right? And we had like a little, you know, we didn't bring any food out there with us. And we did have a little late lunch, early dinner type of thing, which was really cute. That was a really good day.
Yeah, it was. Lebanon's just such a cool little downtown. It's like, I asked myself as I was leaving there, like, why don't I come here more often? I guess it's probably because it's 35, 40 minutes away.
For us, it's far.
Yeah, right, exactly. Neat place up in Warren County. And if you're looking for a place to kayak, I would encourage anyone to go to Caesars Creek, the North Pool Launch Ramp is what it's called. So what else you got, Sherry? Did you go to fireworks over the weekend?
No, because I was too tired. We were supposed to go to the Coney Island ones, and I was like, oh, no. You know what I will say? Here's what I've been doing. I have been going for like longer walks in the morning. It turns out I was sitting at my work desk too long in my guest room. And I have to tell you, I am in love with East Price Hill. I can't believe how much it's changed and just how much is going on there. One of our friends, Mike Betts, who used to work at the Enquirer, he moved there. Just, you know, a little jaunt for me to get to him. And we like the hills, because he certainly can come to me too, but the hills there makes for a really good sweaty walk, which is what I need with so much sitting. And I just love seeing the houses, and we just kind of like mosey along, and we stop at Block Coffee, and, you know, I get a green tea, and I have my little order already, and I'm really enjoying this neighborhood. And, you know, I've right every once in a while in a line, up and coming neighborhood, East Price Hill, and East Basement, and it is just really, I think it's going to be just this spectacular neighborhood coming.
Go ahead.
You can still see the diversity there too. And I'm enjoying it.
I tell you mentioned East Price Hill and that area. My first thought is Vera Cruz Restaurant, which is
we walk by there some. We love some. We've been patio dining there some because it's near us. And they have a gorgeous patio out behind some. Where there's a little waterfall and they put a cover on. They really invested knowing that there's going to have to be so much outdoor dining. And so those are two of our favorite places.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such cool places up there. Like you said, Block Coffee and Vera Cruz and Incline Public House and all the work that folks are doing on, with houses and buying houses and redoing houses and really a neat area. And then top it all off is the awesome view of downtown from certain parts of that little neighborhood as well, and just a majestic view of the whole urban core of Cincinnati. You can also see uptown and downtown, and just a neat place, and the river right there. So I didn't know you had been hanging out in East Price Hill more.
I have been. I was scurrying home to get to the podcast interview today.
Oh, it's pretty good. You went out this morning for a walk.
I did, because you just ramble around, and then it was like, oh, what time it is? I'm like, oh, I gotta go.
Love it. Great stuff. Sherry, I was getting ready to ask you something else about 4th of July, but I don't remember. Anyway, everyone, thank you so much for listening, and thanks for all the feedback and on last week's episode. If you missed last week's with Hamilton County Auditor Dusty Rhodes, certainly go back and check that out. We're rolling again with the podcast, and we're keeping it rolling. Lot of big guests coming up here in the near future, and just appreciate your support of the podcast. Let us know you have someone you want to recommend as a guest, or hey, I like that, or I didn't like that about the podcast. We want to make this better. We want to know what we're doing well, what we need to do better, and so we want to hear from you. Our emails are jwilliams@inquire.com and scoolidge@inquire.com, on Twitter as well, @jwilliamscincy with a Y, and @sharoncoolidge, @jwilliamscincy with a Y. And love to hear your feedback, and appreciate your support of this podcast.
Some coworker shout outs real quick. You mentioned Aaron Glenn, covered that hearing. Well, I took my first day off this year on Friday. Of course, there was a council meeting. I felt like I was like, I will listen to being by taking off. I had thought that hearing was actually going to be this week. So thanks to her for covering that. I just assume that, it's fun to cover council. So, and this week, Jesse Ballmer and Jackie Borchert up in Columbus, these mask mandates, this is not a Cincinnati thing. It's starting to happen all over the state. And so they're doing a lot of reporting on this. And Hannah Sparling also is helping me out some this week while I work on a project story unrelated to City Hall. I don't want to really be like a tease like that. Something I'm just trying to get done. And Hannah is being a saint to help me. So love our coworkers.
Love our coworkers. What a great team. I miss everyone. It was great hanging out with you. It was the first time you and I had hung out since all this really started. We briefly saw each other at Holly Campbell's going away event a few weeks ago, but really the first time you and I face-to-face had seen each other since early March when all this stuff started. And certainly miss our coworkers, but the beauty of iPhones and Zoom and Microsoft Teams, and we're all connected, and we're keeping it all going, keeping Cincinnati.com cranked up, and the newspaper is printing every day, and this podcast is happening, and as we do it over conference call, instead of sitting in our awesome studio in the newsroom. But yeah, thanks to everyone for all your support. I know many of you are also your Uber news local news consumers, and you're also subscribers to Cincinnati.com and the Inquirer. So thank you so much. If you're not, we're always running deals. Just go to Cincinnati.com/subscribe. Check it out. Different levels of offers there that you can choose from. And, you know, I think the year of 2020 has shown the importance of local journalism and journalism in general, and good journalism. I don't need to go into a big speech about that with all the news that's happened. So thanks so much, and we will catch you next week.